Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's great to spend this afternoon with you looking at these two chapters, two long chapters. If you get the opportunity, we just dipped in. We kind of parachuted into certain key bits of a very long text. But if you get the opportunity tonight, just go back and read the two chapters. See the way the story unfolds. One of the things that I think is quite interesting as you read a couple of chapters in narrative like this, it becomes really quite confusing. What is going on at certain points? What's happening? Back in 1800, a Prussian general by the name of Karl von Clausewitz said this: "War is the realm of uncertainty. Three quarters of the factors on which action in war is based are wrapped in a fog of greater or lesser uncertainty." That long sentence has got boiled down into a phrase that is used a lot of times, particularly in the news and when you're hearing military people referring to the conflict, talking about the issue of the fog of war. What's going on? So many decisions seem to be spontaneous, responding to the situation that's there in front of us. Is that what war is like in the Old Testament? Well, to some extent, yes. But then to another extent, what we're called to do, I think, is place chapters like this into the golden thread of the storyline of the Bible. Because there's huge issues at stake. If the battle had not unfolded the way it did unfold, we would not be here today. There would be no Christian church. There would be no faith. There was something that happened in that battle which we can remind ourselves of as we turn to the Bible is this. There is a greater general who is orchestrating every step in these seemingly confusing battle scenes. And it is the determination of God in the futile mess of humanity, in the rebellion of humanity, to ensure that his divine redemptive purpose will be achieved in the world. That is what is behind two chapters like this. It is the determination of God against all of the opposition of humanity to make sure that his purpose is fulfilled, to make sure that his redemption is achieved. So we're going to go through this. When I say I'm going to go through 7 points, don't panic. We're going to go quick. But we're going to look at a treasonous plot. We're going to look at the power behind the throne, the tragedy of rebellion, the dethroning of an imposter, the desire for a name, the mourning victor, and the flavors of redemption. So let's go for the first one, the treasonous plot. Ahithophel said to Absalom, "I would choose 12,000 men and set out tonight in pursuit of David." That's what his assessment was of the situation. Ahithophel, focus all of your attention, Absalom. Do one thing, take out the king. That's the idea that Ahithophel brings to Absalom. Just take out the king. It's all you need to do. There's a previous verse to this. Listen to what it says in chapter 16 and verse 23. "Now in those days, the advice Ahithophel gave was like that of one who inquires of God. That was how both David and Absalom regarded all of Ahithophel's advice." His insight was so clear, so directed, and so consistently, it seems, kind of covered with the insight of God's purposes, that both David and Absalom listened to his advice as though God was speaking to them. And Absalom takes this in. And what we see unfold in this treasonous plot is we see Absalom listening to both sides, two arguments, and that's how it unfolds. Ahithophel says, strike the king. And then another one comes in and gives him Absalom a whole other way of looking at it. But the word of God, through Ahithophel, it seems, was the right advice. This treasonous plot that we read here would have been successful if Absalom had followed it through. If Absalom had said, Ahithophel, you've been consistently God's word to us. I'm going to listen to you as though I'm listening to God. And that is the key idea behind this moment, is that Absalom is not determined to listen to God. He's seeking the best advice from people around him for his own purposes, but this would have worked. If David had been taken out by a strike force, Absalom would have won. That's the treasonous plot. How do we know that it would have won? How can you be so sure that that would have been a victorious plot if you'd have determined to follow through? If Absalom had said, I'm going to listen to Ahithophel, he's been right all along, that's what we're going to do. The second reason is because we see this. There is a greater power behind the throne. The greater power behind the throne of David. Verse 14 says this. Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel. I'm not going to listen to what has been consistently God's advice. I'm going to listen to Hushai. Why? Why did Absalom make that decision? Why did he abandon, in a sense, God's consistent word? He abandoned it for the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom. Isn't that incredible? The advice that Absalom first received would have been the right advice. And yet God is the power behind this battle. It's one of those moments where if we can latch onto that verse, we start to clear some of the fog of war. And we see that, okay, there is all sorts of advice flying around, there's decisions being made, armies moving in various directions, people chasing all over the place, but behind it is God's intention to disrupt the plan of Absalom. The real conflict we see here is human conflict against God's purposes. It's the determination that God's purposes will be victorious in spite of rebellion. That verse is the greatest bit of news that we can hear, in a sense. It's the greatest bit of news that we can hear when we look at our hearts in relation to God's purpose in our lives. How often do you rebel? How often do I rebel? If underneath all of that, there is a trust in God, there is a determination in God to frustrate your rebellion. Your rebellion will be frustrated because he has determined that he will be victorious and your faith that he has placed in your heart will succeed in spite of our determination at times to rebel and to battle against God's will in our hearts. What does that look like? Time and time again, our treasonous plots become incredibly painful for us. Our rebellion becomes painful. God does not leave us in comfortable places in our rebellion and sin. He militates, he fights because of that verse, because he is determined to frustrate the plans of our rebellion, because he is determined that we will one day raise our eyes and see him face to face and praise his name. Because there is a greater power behind the throne. Next, we see the tragedy of rebellion. What happens to Ahithophel? Look at verse 25. When Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and set out for his house in his hometown. He put his house in order and then hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. That seems so extreme, doesn't it? It seems so extreme that why has he done that? Why is Ahithophel determined that because his advice wasn't taken, that there's no way out for him? I think it's something like this. Because he knew that the solution that he was bringing was the only solution that would be successful. Because he had that conviction that he was speaking the mind of God, but God has determined to frustrate that rebellion. And then he realizes that no matter what Absalom does, from this moment on, David is going to be victorious. Because as Absalom has not listened to him, he's gone off in his own direction. And David is going to be victorious. And when David returns as king, he is going to be exposed as the treasonous rebel. What a tragedy. Somebody who clearly had walked alongside David consistently, giving him insight that was shaped, that had the flavor of God's purposes. That's what we read in the last verse of the previous chapter. That Ahithophel had that experience of, with David, he had been a faithful insight and companion to David. And now David will return. And he will prove to be a rebel. There's a little flavor there, isn't there? There was somebody else who walked alongside a king for 3 years. And at the decisive moment decided to sell him for 30 pieces of silver. At the decisive moment, Judas decided that the momentary benefits and wealth of here and now is greater than that relationship that he had forged for 3 years, and he rebelled and he sold Jesus. I wonder how much the same experience of Ahithophel was in the heart of Judas when he had sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, and he knew deep down in his heart that this was not a win. This is not a win. I'm not going to be victorious because I've sold Jesus out. I've sold him out and I have still lost and I have got nowhere to go. You know, the voices, the specters of Ahithophel and Judas lie over us today as we read this text, that we might not reach that point of saying, after all of this walk alongside this Jesus, there is a decisive moment in my life when I will ultimately and completely rebel and turn against him. A tragedy of rebellion. The next thing we see is the dethroning of an impostor. A battle goes on, and clearly David's men gain the victory. But then in verse 9 of chapter 18, we read this remarkable event. And it is remarkable. Now, Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was retreating. He was out of it. He was riding his mule. And as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's hair got caught in the tree. Can you picture it? Do you know what? I'll be honest. I thought that sounds just so incredibly extreme. Can you be suspended by your hair? That's a really interesting question to ask Wikipedia. Thankfully, Wikipedia confirmed you can be suspended by your hair. In fact, it's a circus act, apparently. You can be suspended by your hair. Absalom was dragged by his hair off his mule. The symbolism is incredible. Deuteronomy talks about the nature of kings who are to be appointed, and that they are not to gather around them great war horses. And out of that gained a tradition where kings of God's people would ride on mules, it seems. David appoints Solomon to be his successor and causes Solomon to ride on David's mule. Later on, Zechariah prophesied 500 years later to say that the coming king will ride into Jerusalem on a mule. There is something incredibly symbolic about a king riding on a mule. Ultimately, Jesus, the king, rides into Jerusalem on a mule. He's fulfilling what Zechariah says is going to happen, that the king will come like that. David, it must have been a tradition because David appoints Solomon to ride on a mule. Here is Absalom, who has claimed to be king, who is dethroned from that statement of kingship, not by any other warrior, not by any of David's men, but he is dragged off the mule by what would have been the very statement of his beauty, his hair. It's as though God is saying, you might think that you're going to be king, but let me just make it really clear in picture terms, in symbolic terms, that the frustration is not just the victory that will be assured, but I will make it so bizarrely obvious that I am dragging you off your status as king. The usurper of authority, the imposter, the one who stepped in and demanded in rebellious terms to be king, is dragged off the king's mule and is hanging by his hair. Joab, really frustrated, one of his men tells him that he saw Absalom hanging by his hair and didn't finish him off, and they go and finish him off. What a tragic end. Tragic end for Absalom. But it seems to me as though the narrative is written in such a way that we are reminded again of whose victory this is. We're reminded again that it is God who is working in a remarkable way to ensure that David is victorious. Last week, Ash mentioned a verse which is fundamental. Two chapters earlier, David flees Jerusalem. And David the king said to Zadok, "Take the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. If I find favor with God, I'll see the ark again." Why did David have favor in God's eyes? Well, from what we've seen previously, very clearly not because he was a perfect righteous person. He had favor in God's eyes because it was God who had appointed him. He was God's man in God's place at God's time. And God was determined that God's man in God's place at God's time would achieve the purposes of God for the sake of his people. And no upstart son rebelling against his father king would ever be able to overthrow the purposes of God. Then we have this little incident where we kind of have almost a microscope. We have a microscope into the heart of Absalom. Verse 18. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself, for he thought, "I have no son to carry on the memory of my name." He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. If we are in any doubt that Absalom's act was anything other than a self-exalting rebellion, the narrator adds this little reminder that the thing that he wanted to do was make a name for himself. He had no living name. He had no heritage of continuation, but he wanted to be remembered. He wanted to be seen. He wanted to be recognized. So read that. There's one verse that just popped up in my head in something that Jesus said when he said this. Don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Absalom just wanted a great stone pillar, a treasure on earth for him to be remembered. And it's so temporary. It's here and gone and past. It's finished and gone. And yet he was in the stream of knowing the living God who opened up to him all of the potential of being able to know eternal life and security for eternity. And yet he wanted the now more than he wanted the relationship with David's God. The desire for a name, an inheritance, something that finally for us reminds us of what Absalom's heart was really like. Then we see the morning victory. Verse 32, there's a really fascinating little bit of narrative where two runners end up running to the king. One gains advantage over the other, brings the news first, kind of fudges it as to whether Absalom had actually been king. Wasn't really clear, and then the second one comes along and the runner gives him the news that his son has died. The king asked the Cushite, that's the second runner, is the young man Absalom safe? The Cushite replied, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to him to harm you be like that young man." The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. What astounding grace. A desperation of a loving father that his rebellious son had not pursued the journey that he had gone on. But there is this huge open door for the storyline of the Bible in just that verse. It's just this huge open door. My son, Absalom, you rebel, my son, Absalom. You wanted to take my place. You wanted to reject me. You who wanted to be king instead of me. My son, if only I had died instead of you. Every one of us are Absaloms. Every one of us are rebels against the king. And David cries out, a heart of grace, but helpless words. Because there's no way that he can bring life back to Absalom. And yet there comes a day when just what David says is fulfilled by another David. Another David who doesn't say, if only I could die instead of you. A Jesus who says, I will die instead of you. I know you have rebelled. I know that you have turned your back on me. I know that you want to be king of your lives rather than me, king of your lives. And if you carry on in that direction, there is the helplessness of David. And yet Jesus has the power to say, but I can die instead of you. And I will die instead of you. And the strategic plan that Ahithophel brings to, instead of wiping out all of the army, instead of wiping out a significant part of the nation, just kill one king, comes to its fulfillment when just one king is killed, so that rebels can go free, so that those who have rejected him might turn again to him and live. You see, where God thwarts the plan of Ahithophel, God doesn't thwart the plans of those who take Jesus and crucify him. He doesn't thwart their plans. Why doesn't God thwart their plans in that moment? Because just like this, if we clear the fog of war, it's God's plan that his son is going to be sacrificed. That's why he doesn't thwart the plans of the rebels who take Jesus and slay him. Because it looks like they are rebelling, but actually it is God's purpose that his son is killed, so that Jesus is able to say, my children, not if only I had died instead of you. My children, I will die instead of you. See, God brings the two together. He brings together a king who will die instead of his son. But he also, instead of the tragedy that that would be, he turns it to victory, because the king who dies instead of his son is also the king who lives as well as his son. In fact, his son who rebels, who lives, because the king who is sacrificed dies instead of him, lives because the king lives. And in that moment, as C.S. Lewis portrays brilliantly, when Aslan is slaughtered on the stone table in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the stone cracks, and then we realize, as C.S. Lewis says, there is a deeper magic. There is a deeper storyline. There is something else going on. There is something more. It has always been purposed in this way, because when it looks like the king is dethroned and slaughtered, the reality is, it is the enemy that dies at that moment. and all rebellion against King Jesus is defeated in his resurrection. It's defeated. It doesn't look like in this world today, does it? It doesn't feel like. It doesn't feel like in our own hearts. It doesn't feel like the battle is won. But the battle is won. Because there's a greater general behind the war. And we're living in the fog of war right now, of spiritual warfare. There is a fog of war that is going on in our own hearts, in the journey of God's people in the world, in all of that kind of stuff. There is a fog of war. Paul says you're fighting against principalities and powers and dark forces that are not of this world. That's the battle that is going on. But there is a general who is already won. And paradoxically, just like David, who mourns the rebel, God, who does not delight in the death of the wicked, seeks those who have rebelled against him to see hope in a king who will die instead of them. Pray that we might all know that personally.